One of the things about being retired, and Jane, you didn't have to say it was here last century. One of the things about being retired is you get occasionally get invited to preach in a church, and I've learned the secret of getting invited back. You tell a couple of really cute stories about your perfect grandchildren. You find a passage of scripture that's non-threatening and filled with love, and then you kind of close with a little funny story at the end. Always works. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen today. Really, I was reading the Hebrew Bible from 2 Samuel. We don't often read that in our lectionary, but it was there today. And as I read it, I was struck by what I was seeing. It is the story of the rise and fall of King David. Now, the stories about David are found elsewhere in the Bible, and we know of David as the great king who united all the Jewish people together, who helped with the building of Jerusalem, the great capital, who wrote the Psalms. But in 2 Samuel, the description of David is one that comes unvarnished, warts and all. We see David as the young man who overthrew King Saul, who had been his mentor and the one who had raised him into leadership. We see David as the one who wasn't satisfied to do battle in defense of his people, but who went out every single year to conquer new lands and new people. We see David as the one who very often, in order to intimidate enemies, would capture the leader and decapitate them, hang their head on the wall. We see David as someone who, after a battle, would often slay all of the soldiers opposed to him and carry the women and children off into slavery and his concubines. We see David as a man of lust, a man of revenge. It's all there. And the worst part of it is the section that was scheduled for this week, the end of chapter 11 and the beginning of chapter 12, is that place where David finally, in a sense, goes too far. And he begins his descent. You probably know the story. It's the story of David and Bathsheba and Uriah. Uriah was a lieutenant in David's army and a very trusted one, a very loyal one. A man who would do anything for his king. And as was the habit, every single spring, as 2 Samuel reminds us, every spring David went off to conquer somebody. This year it was the Ammonites' turn. And he sent Joab, his general, and the armies off to do battle, and he stayed back in Jerusalem. And one hot day he went up on the roof of, which was a flat roof, and he went up there to get a breath of fresh air, and he looked down, and there a couple of houses away was a courtyard with a wall around it, but he, being way up, could look down and see, and there was a bath. And there was a woman, and she was bathing. And David was filled with lust. And so he sent his servants to bring her to the palace, and he raped her. Send her home. Now, a couple of weeks later, she sent word to David, "I'm with child." Well, what's David going to do? Her husband, Uriah, has been out with the army for the last 2 months. She's with child. How's he going to cover this up, as he's been covering up mistakes all of his life? Well, he had a plan. He sent for Uriah, and he brought him back to the palace under the pretense of wanting to know how the battle against the Ammonites was going. Uriah, being a loyal servant of the king's, sat and told him in every detail what was happening in the battle, and David pretended to be oh so interested. Really? And then what happened? And then, as darkness settled, he said, "Uriah, you've been such a good soldier. Before you go back to the front, I want you to go home, sleep in your bed, be with your wife, have a good meal. Uriah left the palace, but he didn't go home. He went and he slept in the courtyard of the palace on the cold, hard ground. Well, the next morning when David found out, of course, his plan was ruined. He called Uriah in and he said, "Why didn't you go home as I told you to?" And Uriah said, "My lord, my men are fighting for you. They're sleeping on the cold, hard ground. They're eating bad food. They're under the stars at night. How could I, in good conscience, go home and stay in my own bed?" Well, it's time for Plan B, isn't it? So David came up with Plan B, and it was simply to get Uriah so drunk that he wouldn't know where he was, what he was doing. So he invited him to a banquet. He said, "Before you go back, I want a banquet for you." And they had a banquet that night. And he kept feeding Uriah wine and more wine and more wine. And finally he sent him and he said, "Now you go home and sleep that off." But Uriah went out into the courtyard and he slept on the cold, hard ground because that's where his men were. Now, David had a real problem, didn't he? What do you do with someone who's so loyal to you that he's ruining everything? So, Plan C. David wrote a letter to Joab, his general, and he said, "I want you to create an offensive against the strongest part of the Ammonite army. And I want Uriah to be leading that offensive and charging into it. And as soon as the Ammonites answer and start coming back in a counterattack, pull all your men back and make sure that Uriah is dead." And then he folded the letter and he put his seal on it and he gave it to Uriah to carry to the general. And so it happened. Uriah was killed. And Joab sent a messenger back to the king, and knowing that the king would be very unhappy that he had lost some other men too, he said, "Explain this to the king, and when the king gets angry and he rages against you, simply say, 'But Uriah is dead.'" And so it happened. Now, the scripture lesson for today picks up the story. When word came back that Uriah was dead, his wife was deeply hurt and went into mourning. But as soon as the mourning period was over, David had her picked up, brought to the palace, married her, and later she bore a child, a son. Not a very pretty story, is it? Well, it doesn't end there. Because there was a man named Nathan who was sort of, I guess you would call him the court chaplain. He was the prophet. He seemed to have the ear of God. And he found out exactly what David had done. But he knew that he couldn't confront him face on. He'd probably get killed himself. So he went to the king and he said, "My king, I have a story I want to tell you. There were two men in a village. One was very, very rich, had herds of animals and flocks of sheep and goats and had everything he could possibly want in life. And the other one was a poor man. And he scraped together all that he had and he bought a little goat. A little lamb. And he brought the lamb home, and his children loved the lamb. It became a pet in the family. They would feed it out of their hands, and they would give it drink out of their cups. And the lamb would even sleep with the family and often have its head on the poor man's chest as he went to sleep. And he treated that little lamb like a daughter. Well, one day, the rich man had a guest come to his house. And not wanting to disturb his own flock, he sent and took the lamb away from the poor man, had it slaughtered and ate it. David heard the story and said, "My God, how could he do such a thing? A man with no pity? He should be killed." And Nathan said, "You are the man." And for the first time, David saw himself as what he had become. He looked in the mirror, and instead of seeing this man who believed himself to be chosen by God to be a great king, who therefore could do anything he wanted with the arrogance of his power, he now saw himself for all the tragedy that he had brought into the lives of others. And the rest of his life, he paid a price. His own son rose up in a civil war against him. Other tribes fought against him. He died a broken old man. I told you this wasn't a funny story. It's a tragic story, isn't it? And after I read that whole of the book of Samuel, I said to my wife, I said, "Jim, you know this story." And her response was, "Some things never change." Isn't that a tragic truth? It's almost as if history repeats itself, doesn't it? Over and over again. It's almost as if history is a great big huge flywheel. You know what a flywheel is? One of those really heavy wheels that goes round and round. And history is a flywheel that keeps repeating itself over and over again. And the flywheel crushes the poor and those on the margins and those who have little or nothing and those who are on the outside. And the flywheel is fueled by arrogance or greed or violence or hatred. And the tragedy is that those who are fueling the flywheel, those who have the arrogance, the hatred, the violence, the anger, the prejudice, whatever it is that's fueling it, always have a reason for it. They rationalize it, don't they? David said, "But I'm the chosen king of God. I can do what I want." And how many times in this world do we see the powerful, the rich, the wheel turning? And the poor and the marginalized and the hurting getting crushed under its weight. And always there's a good reason. We're the chosen people. We're bringing civilization to the world. We're the ones who make everything work. We're going to bring democracy to the poor. We're going to those folks in those far off lands to teach them how to be human. We're, you know how many excuses? And the wheel, generation after generation, goes round and round and round and round. And the poor and the broken and the marginalized get crushed. But, Jesus knew only too well what that wheel was like. He lived in the time of the Roman Empire, which was a crushing wheel, wasn't it? But he also understood that there was the possibility to stop the wheel, to keep it from turning, to keep it from crushing, to keep it from destroying. And how do you do that? Jesus understood only too well exactly how you have to, what you have to do in order to keep the wheel from turning and crushing and destroying. And it was simply to go, "Stop! Stop!" The older I, and the more I read the Gospels, the more I am astounded by Jesus' wisdom. If you read the parables, what are they about? They're about stopping. It's about the ones on the bottom, under the wheel, getting crushed and marginalized and broken and shattered. And it's about them. It's not about the rich and the powerful. And when he does talk about the rich and powerful, remember how he said, it is so hard for them to understand. They always have a reason for what they do, and they fail to look in the mirror and see what they really are doing. They fail to see what's happening. But Jesus didn't just talk about stopping. He lived stopping, didn't he? He lived stop. His whole life was a rejection of what the rich and powerful would want him to do. Some wanted him to fight back with violence, and he said, when they strike, you turn the other cheek. Stop. They won't know what to do. They won't know what to do. And when they brought him to trial, and the Romans had this show trial for him, and they were going to show how their justice really worked, and Pilate said to him, they say you are the king of the Jews, right? Jesus wasn't going to play that game. You say so. Stop! I'm not going to play your ridiculous rationalizing games that you think gives you permission to crush the world. And then when they marched him up to the hill and they nailed his hands and his feet to the cross and they hung him up to die a painful death, what did he say? Forgive them. It wasn't weakness. That was the power of someone who believed enough that God created us not to be crushed, not to be marginalized, not to have arrogance suddenly wheel and turn and destroy us. But he knew that God had created us for happy lives, for possibilities, for new ways of being, for loving each other, for caring about what happens to the planet. He created us for all of that, not to be crushed under the wheels of arrogance and violence and hatred. It is so easy, isn't it, for us to rationalize being part of it. We all are. We all are. We fall into that so easily. Help but notice, one of my causes with Frank, you know, since I took up fly fishing and you got me involved in this, and my wife doesn't speak to you anymore, you know, I've been so concerned about, you know, the environment. You know, you see it when you go up country, what's been happening, and how much of our arrogance there is. Well, we can do whatever we want to the water and the air and the land, and we can dig it up, and you know, we'll be okay. I must say, it was really written loud and clear when the Pope published his recent encyclical on the environment. It was a brilliant piece. He took the work that had been done by so many theologians over the past 30 or 40 years, and he put it together with the work of some economists and some environmentalists. And what he was really talking about was the wheel. How those of us in the first world who despoil the environment and suck all of the goodness out of the earth, the ones who suffer are the poor. Any of you have been to the third world know how terrible it is, the pollution that goes on there. And he wrote this wonderful encyclical saying our moral duty was really to stop and look at ourselves and see what we're doing. Look in the mirror and don't see arrogant me saying, well, I know how to do this. Look at arrogant me saying, how do I fix this? And when he wrote the encyclical, I heard a reporter ask one of the people running for president who happens to be Roman Catholic, about the Pope's encyclical. And he said, I don't take economic or political advice from the Pope. Let him stick to morals. Well, he was sticking to morals. You missed the point. It's about the poor and the suffering and the broken and the hurting and what we're doing to them. He missed it. And so do we so often miss the point of what's happening when we agree to let the wheel keep turning. But you know, it's pretty, very, very hard to say stop. And it's even harder to live stop because so much around us is pulling us into it, isn't it? Pulling us into just letting things go the way they are. It's really hard. But that's why this table was set for us today. Because what Jesus knew was that on our own, we wouldn't make it. But with him, we can. And that bread is the bread of life. And that bread is Jesus saying, I'm going to be with you. I know it's going to be hard, but I'm going to be with you. You're not going it alone. So don't be afraid to say stop. And then with the cup, Jesus is saying, I know you're going to fall down. And I know you're going to get trapped. And I know you're going to make mistakes. But you know what? It's okay. This blood is a sign that I forgive you. And I'm going to lift you up and go back at it again. Don't give up. The wheel turns. I am not a pessimist. In spite of everything you've heard this morning, I'm an optimist. Because, you see, I believe that once a critical mass of people, not the majority, but a critical mass, have the courage to stand up and say, stop, and live lives that say, stop, and illustrate lives that say, stop, it'll stop. And God is inviting me. God is inviting you. God is inviting all of us. Will we answer when the call comes? Will we have enough faith in the bread of life? Will we have enough faith in the forgiveness of the wine? Will we have enough faith in the love of God to say stop? Amen.